Over his career, Jerome Buting has spent hundreds of hours in courtrooms representing defendants in criminal trials. Interweaving his account of the Stephen Avery trial at the heart of Netflix's Making a Murderer with other high-profile cases from his criminal defense career, Buting explains the flaws in America's criminal justice system and what he believes is a blueprint for reform. His new book is Illusion of Justice, Inside Making a Murderer and America's Broken System, and we welcome Jerome Buting to the roundtable. Very nice to have you on the program. What brought you to this particular subject of wanting to look at this account?
Well, I've been practicing law for 35 years now, and I've seen some of the things that the common themes that you see in Making a Murderer regarding the Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey cases, I've seen in many other cases. And when that documentary seemed to catch the public's interest, I thought this was a good chance to explain how common or unique that particular case was, and I have some ideas on what we can do to try and fix what I call a broken system.
When you look at that broken system, where do you see the greatest deficiencies in regards to this case? Why is it such a good example of pointing out those deficiencies?
Well, probably the biggest... that is the single biggest thing that shocked people the most in Making a Murderer was what happened to Brendan Dassey and the kind of interrogation techniques that they saw, which unfortunately are utterly commonplace in this country. Really only this country. The rest of the English-speaking world has moved on, but American law enforcement until very, very recently has really clung to this particular interrogation technique known as the Reed technique, and when applied to juveniles or vulnerable adults, and in Brendan's case, he was not only 16 years old but also had mental limitations. It's been shown to have a too high of an incidence of false confessions, and so that's one of the things that I think is probably most in need of reform in our system. But also, only about half of the states even have mandatory recording of custodial interrogations. And so really in only half of those states would you have ever had a chance to see what the police say, what the defendant says, how the police say it, how he says it. Really the best evidence for a judge or a jury to see. That's only available now in about half the states, and it really should be mandatory in every state that all such recordings be kept, recorded, and continuously from the very beginning to the end, so that there's no turning off the tape and hiding certain parts.
What was it about the fact that this became a very successful documentary, is that something that you look back on and say that was a good thing, that this was viewed by so many people? Or if you had your druthers, you say, I kind of wish we just did the case the way we would normally do a case?
Well, no. I mean, certainly we didn't expect that there would be this kind of coverage of a documentary. It's been 10 years ago now since we did the trial, and it was a very high-profile trial. It was being streamed live on the internet, and it was being viewed by lots of people. But still, we didn't expect that 10 years later a documentary would come out and that it would have this kind of widespread appeal. It's been a big change for Dean and I in the last year in terms of our personal lives, but it's also, I think, been a really important eye-opening experience for the public to finally see what goes on in their courtrooms. Too often, our courtrooms are like black boxes that only the insiders really know what's going on, and this gave people a chance to see what happens in a serious case, and a lot of what they saw they didn't like.
Were there certain things that they didn't see that you wish that they had?
Well, I mean, sure, it's a six-week-long trial. There's, you know, obviously the documentary filmmakers couldn't cover everything. You know, there's defense evidence that was left out. There's some prosecution evidence that's left out. But it, by and large, the pieces that were most fought over by both sides were pretty well covered and pretty thoroughly covered from both sides. So I can't fault the filmmakers for the editorial choices they made. They had to, you know, condense all of, I don't know, you know, hundreds of hours of videotape of actual courtroom footage, and they had to, I think they still ended up with 3 or 3.5 hours of actual courtroom video in the documentary. So, you know, we didn't have any control over what they put in, and, you know, but I can't really fault them for their choices.
Give us an idea of how you first became involved in Stephen Avery's defense.
Well, of course, I knew about the Stephen Avery case, his 1985 wrongful conviction, because that was widely publicized all over the state. At that time, he was the longest wrongfully incarcerated person in our state's history. And there were public hearings that were convened. A legislative task force was set up to try and see what went wrong in that case, see what kind of reforms to the criminal justice system we could do. I was invited to participate on that panel. So I actually met Stephen when he appeared at a hearing for that task force. And that's, you see that in the documentary. It's when he also meets the victim in his 1985 case for the first time. And then when he was charged with the Teresa Halbach murder, I was as stunned as anybody else. It really didn't seem like the man that I saw in that courtroom, or in that legislative hearing, I should say. So I followed it for the first few months while it was beginning its way through the system, and then got a call from Dean Strang one day saying that he'd been retained to take over the case, and would I be interested in working with him on it to represent Stephen. And so I said, well, let's talk about it. And then I was meeting with him in his office on March 1st when he got a phone call from some family member saying, oh, my God, you know, they've arrested Brendan, and they say he's confessed. So, you know, right at the when things really started heating up is when I got onto the case.
You write at length in the book about the Ralph Armstrong case, another of your clients. Give us a sense of the inclusion of that case in the book and the parallels that you wanted to draw.
Well, the main reason, there are two reasons I included it. One is it was another big wrongful conviction case that I was working on, along with Barry Scheck from the Innocence Project, and had been working on it for years when things were started heating up in it at the same time as the pretrial and then trial of Stephen Avery. So there was some chronological overlap. But in addition, there was, as it turned out, there was some pretty shocking developments in Armstrong. I mean, people, after the documentary came out, people say, boy, that Stephen Avery case must have been the craziest case you've ever had, right? And I say, well, not necessarily. I had another one with just as many twists and really with a period of time I was working on a lot more. 15 years I ended up working on the Ralph Armstrong case. And I got a tip in the middle of the Avery trial. I was getting emails from people all over the country, some of them really kooky, some not. And I got a tip from somebody saying, I see you're also representing Ralph Armstrong. I have information that you need to talk to me. And we got an investigator a couple months later. I couldn't deal with it while I was in the middle of the Avery trial. And it turned out that there were two people who had heard a third party confess to the killing, the rape and the killing that my client Ralph Armstrong had been imprisoned for, and they called the prosecutor in the case in Madison and told the whole story to him, and he never disclosed it to the defense. He never made a report, just swept it under the rug for 13 years until we discovered it by this tip. And then, after the after the Stephen Avery trial was over, we also discovered that the prosecutor had violated a court order, had gone into and talked somebody in the clerk's office into releasing a trial exhibit that had previously been retested and found to have had a DNA profile, at least a partial profile, that excluded Ralph Armstrong and excluded the woman's boyfriend. This was a rape and murder. And it was on the presumed murder weapon, which was a terry cloth bathrobe belt draped across her body. She'd been strangled. So clearly exculpatory evidence that he was not to touch, that we were getting prepared to develop through our own defense experts when he violated a court order, had it removed, sent it off to the crime lab for additional testing that destroyed it before the defense could test it. And ultimately, the judge concluded that the prosecutor's misconduct in doing that and in suppressing the confession of the third party for 13 years was outrageous government misconduct, and he dismissed the case. But not until Mr. Armstrong had spent 29 years in custody.
So when it comes to Stephen Avery and the future, what avenues do you believe are there for his pursuit of justice?
Well, there is the opportunity, even years or decades later, as the Armstrong case shows, to reopen a case based on newly discovered evidence. And, you know, after the documentary came out, we were contacted by lots of scientists from really all over the world saying, hey, you know, science has improved in the last 10 years, and there's some new tests you might be able to do that would really help your defense. And some other fact witnesses were also coming forward with information. And so then he retained Attorney Kathleen Zellner, and she has begun using some of those tests to test some of the forensic evidence. So it might well be that there's some new evidence that can be presented to reopen his conviction. Meanwhile, Brendan Dassey had his conviction reversed and the confession thrown out of court by a federal judge last August, but the state appealed that to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, Federal Court of Appeals based in Chicago. They just had oral argument a couple of weeks ago in that case, and a decision is probably going to be several months away, but if the appeals court agrees with the federal judge, then the state will have to either release him or retry him.
Well, the name of the book is Illusion of Justice, Inside Making a Murderer and America's Broken System. The book is published by Harper. Jerome, thank you very much for being with us this morning. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
You're very welcome. It was my pleasure.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Illusion of Justice. It is published by Harper. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.